You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot to talk about today, a lot that we're going to cover today. Walmart in Maine has some interesting stuff going on. There's a fascinating study that just came out of combined work at the London School of Economics and the University of Melbourne about lottery winners. I'll tell you about that. And what winning the lottery does to your politics. It's fascinating. We've got the anti-union pledge card. Missouri is an incredible study that proves the background checks save lives. I just tell you this very quickly. Missouri used to have what's called a permit to purchase rule. So you had to get a permit to own a gun before you could go into a gun store and buy it. They repealed that in 2007. And Johns Hopkins University did a study on this, and they found that as a consequence of that law being repealed, an additional 55 to 63 murders per year in Missouri every year from 2008 to 2012 have occurred. And they controlled for changes in policing, incarceration, burglaries, unemployment, poverty, and other state laws adopted during the study period. All of this apropos, of course, of the Michael Dunn verdict coming back in the Jordan Davis murder over the weekend. Meanwhile, in Arkansas, a group of kids were going to play a prank on another kid by egging his car and then covering it in leaves. And then when he came out to see the car, they were all going to jump up and go, surprise! And what they didn't know was that his dad had a shotgun in the house. And his dad saw them doing it and came out with a shotgun. And when they jumped up to yell surprise, he shot and killed a 15-year-old girl. I'm looking for her name here. We'll get to that. Here it is. In any case, I want to get Neil McCabe on here and talk about this stuff. This is very concerning. Neil is the editor of Guns and Patriots. By the way, Joe Madison is going to be with us after Neil to discuss this as well. He's the editor of a Guns and Patriots column for Human Events, where you'll find his latest column on the Cornyn Stockman U.S. Senate runoff election posted. There's a link on our website. His website, Neil W. McCabe, MCCABE.com. Neil, welcome back.
Great to be opening for Joe Madison.
Joe's a good guy. I look forward to talking to him about this. You wrote in your, I don't know if this was published or if this was just a note you sent Sean about your thoughts on this issue, but you wrote, unlike the rules for our troops in battle, yes, Americans don't have to wait to be shot before defending themselves. And, of course, this is how this guy got off on the first-degree murder conviction, or at least got a hung jury, down in Florida, is he said, I was afraid. And under the stand your ground, shoot first laws, all you have to do is say, I was afraid. It's the same thing that George Zimmerman said. And if the jury can't, or if the prosecution can't prove that you weren't afraid, then your assertion of fear is unchallengeable because the law does not require any objective proof. It only requires an assertion of fear. And both in the Trayvon Martin case and in the Jordan Davis case, the murderers simply asserted they were afraid and therefore avoided a first-degree murder conviction. Why should our troops have to know that they are at risk, be shot at before they can shoot, but, you know, some bozo down in Florida who, in the case of Michael Dunn, he was estranged from his son. They had a horrible relationship, he and his son, basically hated each other. His son got married. He went to the wedding. He had words with his son, slammed down a bunch of drinks. He and his girlfriend left. He had been divorced from his son's mother and had a bunch of drinks. They stopped at a liquor store, a convenience store, to get some more booze. She went in to get it along with some chips. And meanwhile, you know, a carload of teenagers, African-American teenagers, sitting next to him playing loud music, and he starts yelling at him and going off on him. I just don't understand how you could in any way defend that or justify that.
Well, it's glad to be on with you, Tom, and have that opportunity. First of all, I think that if you spoke to the troops in the field, to a man, they would tell you that they are very uncomfortable with the rules of engagement and that they feel like they're being set up as sitting ducks. But that's not really what we want to talk about.
Well, if that sentiment was true, it would go up the line of command and you would see a change in the rules of engagement.
Not necessarily, Tom. And you're speaking to someone who has to take an annual rules of engagement training class every year as part of my Army Reserve service.
Mm-hmm.
And every time there is fierce debate and argument with the poor JAG officer who has to explain to the Joes why they have to sit and be shot at.
Right.
But the second thing is, with Zimmerman, although the left wanted to make it about stand your ground, his defense was not actually stand your ground.
But had stand your ground not been included in the jury instructions, and we know this now from interviews with the jurors, had the judge explicitly included stand your ground in the jury instructions and said, if you cannot knock down his assertion that he felt at fear, if you cannot demonstrate that he had no fear, then you cannot convict him.
And I'll grant you that, Tom, but you still have to, it's not the absolute case that you described, and I think the left overblew that. But getting back to this,
I don't think this is left right. I think this is, you know, pro NRA, anti NRA.
There is a movement in this country to use these cases, in these anecdotes, to justify restricting gun rights.
No, it's not. I'm not suggesting that we should restrict gun rights, although I would be glad to do so in another argument with you, and I have in the past. I'm suggesting that these stand your ground, shoot first laws that were basically written by lobbyists for the National Rifle Association, introduced into the states through the American Legislative Exchange Council via bought off Republican legislators, that these laws that were just there to increase the profits of the gun manufacturers who bankroll the NRA are destructive, that they are hurting us.
Yeah, that's a really twisted narrative. Basically, first of all, people are allowed to petition their Congress. That's fine. The fact of the matter is that if somebody is afraid and afraid for their life, they should have the right to address that fear.
Well, he certainly could have addressed that fear. He could have backed his car out and parked on the other side of the parking lot.
And, you know, as you know, I mean, I live in Silver Spring, Maryland, and there was one particular night at Wheaton Station where somebody was harassing somebody about 20 feet away from me, and I looked over to see what it was, and that guy threw me such a look that I boarded the next bus because I was so, like,
But you did the right thing, Neil. If you're afraid for your life, you get the hell out of there.
But if that guy followed me on the bus, if that guy followed, like, and so the kid went into the train.
Well, now you're providing the justification for Trayvon Martin to have shot George Zimmerman.
Well, listen, I mean, if Trayvon Martin felt that he was in danger.
He clearly was. He ended up dead.
Well, I mean, Trayvon jumped Zimmerman from behind.
According to George.
And started bashing his head into a car, into the...
How do you get jumped from behind when you've been following somebody for 20 minutes?
You're walking back to your truck, Tom.
Yeah.
So from behind, it's very easy. If you're
Neil, let's not relitigate that.
In fact, I think that this is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. I think that it's horrible what happened to this man and his family. But I think that it's also the case that although these tragedies happen, they're exceedingly rare. And unfortunately, that's part of
26 young black men. I think one or two of them have been girls, have been murdered by white people using stand your ground defenses who got off in Florida since that law was passed.
I really don't like the racial spin that you're putting on this.
But that's how it's being used.
I don't think that there's an effort to kill black people using this law.
Okay. Neil McCabe, you know, I embrace your idealism. But yeah. Neil McCabe, neilwmccabe.com. Thanks, Neil.
Take care, Matt. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with Joe Madison for his thoughts on this. And welcome back. Andrew Campbell, Senior Producer of The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew. I've got to put him on the air. It helps if I push the damn button. See, this—it's Monday. I've forgotten everything. Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're welcome. But we're going to start out with need to know, and this is all about the governor in Tennessee saying that if the VW auto plant unionized, he was going to pull their government tax subsidies, and the senator, Bob Corker, saying that he had inside information that if the workers voted to unionize, that Volkswagen would not be expanding their production runs. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's what he said. And, I mean, really, that inside information is hard to find. Volkswagen really hasn't come out against this unionizing effort. And, in fact, if you look at some of the things they've said, it's almost like they're supporting it. I mean, the only people that are truly against this loud and clear are the Republican state lawmakers in Tennessee that, like you said, have threatened to take away tax incentives should VW try to expand in Tennessee. And that's kind of ironic, considering this whole notion Republicans think unions destroy jobs, but if they threaten the tax incentives, that plant's not going to expand and there won't be jobs for the future.
Right.
It's a really interesting thing, and we'll get into it with a guest tonight.
Well, and the simple reality is that the reason the Republicans hate and fear unions is because unions consistently, they're basically, I mean, you got these giant corporations and billionaires who are throwing money at Republicans. It's a form of organized money that consistently supports Republicans. And largely, the only form of organized money that supports Democrats, at least real Democrats, not the sellouts like Max Baucus, is our labor unions. So destroy the labor unions, you destroy the economic and thus political power base of the Democratic Party. From there, we're going to go to the Comcast Time Warner cable deal.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the announcement that Comcast made this past Friday, saying they were going to spend $45 billion to buy Time Warner Cable. Comcast is the largest cable provider in the U.S. Time Warner is the second largest. So this deal, if it goes through, would just create one giant cable and internet service provider company. Would really destroy a lot of competition when it comes to the cable and internet provider marketplace in the U.S., so we'll get into that.
Yeah, and now that the district court, the circuit court, district court, whatever it is, the U.S. district court in Washington, D.C. has struck down net neutrality, we've got, this is, the stakes are really, really high.
Absolutely.
Okay, another kill your ground travesty.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the situation going on in Florida right now. Over the weekend, Michael Dunn was convicted of three counts of attempted murder, but was essentially let off on the murder count. There was a hung jury, which means there will be a trial if the prosecutors seek it. But, I mean, we'll get into just how absurd these standard ground defenses are. I mean, this guy was basically asserting that he was threatened by loud music and that gave him the right to shoot and kill an innocent individual. But there's also been a lot of trivializing going on in the media with everyone referring to this as loud music case, and they really haven't been looking more into it. It's sort of very, very basically been looking at the case, not going in depth to it, which we will do.
Right. And then David Sirota is going to drop by and talk about The Wolf of Sesame Street.
Yeah, PBS isn't as independent as we thought they were.
Yeah, although they seem to be giving the money back now that they've been outed. That's very entertaining. Andrew Campbell, that's what's up tonight. Senior producer of The Big Picture on our TV program. Watch it here on Free Speech TV at 7 o'clock. Andrew, thank you. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Joe Madison on the line with us, host of The Joe Madison Show. JoeMadison.com is the website. It airs daily weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius Channel 128. Twitter, at Black Eagle Power. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
It's always nice to have you with us, although this topic
is not the most pleasant thing to talk about.
Yeah, this topic is not the one that I would like to. But here's something that really struck me. H2O Man had this post over Democratic Underground. I just wanted to read a couple sentences to you and get your take on it. He talks about, first of all, the background of the shooting. He says Dunn had gone to the wedding of his son, with whom he had a failed father-son relationship. Apparently there had been a divorce. The son went with the mother, that kind of thing. He slammed down a handful of drinks, left early, stopped so his lady could pick up more alcohol and chips, got PO'd by some teenagers disrespecting him, got his gun, and then he fled the scene after he'd killed Michael Dunn. And then he goes on to say, in this H2O Man, in this post, goes on to say, some journalists have asked if Michael Dunn told his lies so often that he now believes them. I do not think so. I'm convinced from watching him testify that he knows he is lying. But the real problem is that Dunn does believe he was 100% justified in murdering young Davis, not because he felt afraid, but because he felt entitled. And he honestly believed that even if the police knew he was lying, they couldn't prove it. Your thoughts on that, Joe?
Well, first of all, they did prove that he was lying. In any case where you have a witness that, in fact, was in the car with him, spent hours with him, and testified under oath, you would in fact believe her. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. That was the other great thing about this case, is that they had witnesses and they had evidence. But I heard you talking earlier, Tom, and I'm so glad you brought that aspect of it up, and we'll deal with it on your show tonight. This is not about loud music. This is about what the word you just used, entitlement.
Right.
I'm entitled to fearful. If I see a young black male, maybe with his pants halfway down his behind, I'm entitled to feel fearful. If I hear a group of them together, look, we know this exists. If people talk about, if I see three or four young black men coming at me, I roll up my windows and lock my car door. I grab my purse. Do I do that when I see young white men, young white kids coming at me? I don't know the question and how individuals ask answer that, but it's about perception.
Well, I'm seeing a straight line here, Joe, from the early days from slavery in the United States, of whites in the South fearing slaves who might get loose or might fight back, to I just had a brain fart. The young man who was murdered for whistling at the girl down in the South in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Emmett Till.
Yeah, to Emmett Till, to Trayvon Martin, to Jordan Davis, and that straight line is there has always because whites have always known that blacks are oppressed, whites have been always afraid of the reaction and response, and there's always been that otherness created. And the straight line from lynching to stand your ground, shoot first laws is what I'm seeing, is that what this law says is if you're afraid of somebody, you can shoot them before they have demonstrated that they are a threat to you. You just have to believe that they're a threat to you. And a lot of whites, particularly in the South, believe that somebody is a threat simply because their skin is dark.
And the fear is that we have treated a group of individuals, black people, so badly. You can draw the straight line from lynching. I just saw a program the other day. A great play called The Tallest Tree in the Forest about Paul Robeson and what happened to veterans after World War II who came back with a new sense of empowerment. And the fear was, well, if they get power, well, they may do to us. And revenge.
Right. Well, we did to them.
What we did to them. And there have been social experiments done on that. But people need to understand what happened here. And I made this point because we were on the air an hour after the verdict was read. Understand what happened. That in Florida, you can get 15 years minimum for shooting a car. But you can't get charged. I mean, you can't get a verdict for killing a 17-year-old young man, young boy.
If he's black.
If he's black. That's what happened.
Yeah.
He'll be 122 if he gets minimum sentencing and lives throughout his the other charges. But think about what the justice system did in Florida, what that jury did. Somebody held out. They didn't argue over 15 years for shooting the car. He gets a minimum 15 years for shooting a car. a car is more valuable than the life of that 17-year-old kid.
Yeah. Joe, just 30 seconds left. What does this say for the future of the Stand Your Ground Shoot First Class?
Oh, it says that I'm proactive. We all need black, white, mixed, whatever your demographic is, men, women. We all need to organize and go after that Stand Your Ground law, get it repealed, not only in Florida, but we have to get it repealed in the 20-some other states that have it. All this is part of that Alex group. It's almost legislation verbatim. And that's where this came from. And I'm thinking proactive. I'm thinking the two of us, along with our colleagues of like mind, we've got to get out here. We've got to beat the drum. We've got to send the message. This is a dangerous, crazy law that goes back to the Wild West.
Right.
And everybody knows it, Tom. So I think that's where you go from here.
I agree.
Because
and I think it's
equally apply. Because remember, there's Melissa Alexander who's got a new trial. She used Stand Your Ground. She didn't kill anybody.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sorry, Joe. Heartbreaks.
I'm sorry. Didn't
Joe Madison.
Heartbreak.
JoeMadison.com. Great having you with us, Joe.
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
Well, George Zimmerman speaks. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. The place where despair is not an option. No, there is so much we can do, and there's so much we have to do. Here we have George Zimmerman. He was this is absolutely remarkable. Thank you. I'm the victim. Certainly, I certainly was a victim when I was having my head bashed into the concrete, my nose broken and beaten. I wouldn't say I was not a victim. Was it a miscarriage of justice? He basically said that he says, I was a scapegoat. Who are you a scapegoat for? The president and the attorney general. Those black guys in power, they're why George Zimmerman is not having a good day. Not because he killed a young man that he stalked because he was black, because the young man was black. No, not because of that. This othering of President Obama. When I said that I see a straight line from slavery through lynching through Emmett Till to the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws, I mean that. That the ability of a white person in Florida to go out with a gun and participate in a confrontation with one or more black people, and if they react to him at all, and there's still a debate about whether Trayvon Martin even reacted to George Zimmerman, because the cell phone conversation he was having seemed to indicate he didn't, that he was trying to get away. But, you know, even if you accept George Zimmerman's version of it, if the black person reacts at all to the white person now has justification to shoot him. How is that different than having justification to lynch him? The black person ends up dead either way. Or just, you know, beat him to death like Emmett Till. I mean, it is all the same thing. And the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws accomplished two things. One, they gave white people a legal justification to kill black people. And that's how typically the defense is used, at least in the South, particularly in the South. And two, they drove up gun sales, which, of course, is why the gun manufacturers support the, you know, give all this money to the NRA, which is their lobbying front. And the NRA supported the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, in putting together these Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws and introducing them into 20-some-odd state legislatures via bought-off Republican legislators. I just see this as just this continuous and Armin, if I'm reading this right, would I live in a minority neighborhood without a handgun? That's what it says here. Is that the question you told Danielle you wanted to ask me?
Well, actually, a little bit more than that, if I may. You always like to do facts and statistics. Would you please do what I've done and go back the last 50 years? Go make it 60. Go back right after World War II. And let's take the different races and see what percent of those races after World War II, when we were doing all the manufacturing, about 95% of what we consumed after World War II was made in this country. So we were pretty much, we didn't have the debt, you know, the bankruptcy that we're seeing now into the future.
What's your point? What does this have to do with stand your ground and shoot first?
Go back after World War II when we made everything here and stimulus went to manufacturing and the multiplier of manufacturing and put people to work, common people, made middle class, and go from World War II.
At least a white
middle class. And take the whites, the blacks, and the Hispanics and other minorities, and see what percent per race paid more in taxes into the government than they got back in either government salaries or benefits.
Well, really simple, stupid stuff, Armin. I mean, obviously, white people get 80-90%. Okay, I didn't mean to call you stupid. I apologize. If you took that personally, I didn't mean it that way. But I've heard that argument, and it's quite easily debunked. It's like saying, you know, the top 1% pay a lot of taxes. And some people would suggest, well, the top 10% pay the majority of taxes. Well, yeah, but they make the majority of the income, and the income that they make is a much larger percentage of national wealth than the taxes that they pay. But
you're over-talking me.
I beg your pardon?
Now, if I may continue, please. Now,
but if your question was, would I live in a minority neighborhood without a handgun, I just wanted to have, you know, on the record, I live two blocks from the projects here in Washington, D.C.
Get off your house,
boat. I walk through the Southwest every day.
You don't stay. Let me say this.
Okay.
Have you ever done the statistics? What about this? Is this a fair debate, too? What's the statistics on the white-on-black crimes versus black-on-white crimes? Go down the list. Rape, robbery, everything. And what's the statistics? How many more times do the minorities perpetrate crimes?
What you are going to find, Armin, is that poverty drives crime regardless of race.
What I'm driving home is we got two parties. One party is the corporate, fascist, trickle-nomics, feudalists. That's Republicans. No retirement, no health care, no minimum wage. Just shut your damn mouth and toil for the rich that monopolize the capital and the money. And then we got the Democrats that are the corporate fascists. They vote for the wars. They vote for the unlimited war funding. They're the corporate fascist third world.
So, Armin, what are you going to do about it?
What am I going to do about it?
Yeah, other than call a radio station and yell.
And talk to people that have a concept and an open mind that they can understand.
So you're working on waking folks up. That's a good and noble thing. Step one. Armin, thanks for the call. It's always good to hear from you. It's usually good to hear from you. Carol in Dillon, Montana. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, I was just going to call and find out if you've ever heard the term fighting whiskey.
No, I haven't. I've heard the phrase got my whiskey up, or he got his whiskey up, from when we lived in Atlanta. And I think that meant that somebody was drunk enough to pick a fight in a bar, but I could be wrong.
It extends beyond that. If you're angry, when you go in to drink, you remain angry and it heightens it.
Right. And this was the case with Michael Dunn.
When you leave, you're still driving under the influence. I can't figure out why they didn't have him for that one too. They should have.
Do you know? I didn't. I haven't. I confess. I've been reading this story more in headline than in long, detailed, thoughtful pieces of good reporting. I haven't seen anything that indicated whether they did a breathalyzer test on him. Do you know?
No, I haven't heard.
They couldn't have, because he went home and hung out with his girlfriend, and I think they picked him up the next day, didn't they? It was some considerable time later, because they went home and they had a bunch of drinks. So a breathalyzer test would have been irrelevant, because they stopped at the convenience store. She bought some booze and they went back to his place and they had some more to drink. So there's no way to know how intoxicated he was when he murdered this young man, Jordan Davis.
But Yeah. I think that probably aggravated him to the point where anything would have set him off.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, he went to the wedding of his estranged son. He got angry. He apparently belted down a few. And then he's sitting in the parking lot waiting for his girlfriend to pick up some more booze and picks this fight. Carol, thank you for the call. Thanks for your thoughtful contribution. Tony in Santa Barbara, California. Tony, you wanted to talk about the Jordan Davis case.
Yes. First of all, I want to repeat a quote Malcolm X said years ago, everything below the Canadian border is the South. So let's get that.
Yeah, it seems. And then, which is not to say that they don't have problems in Canada, too.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But basically, what I all these people with all these excuses. First of all, there has not been any massacre of white folks ever. I mean, if you look at what Harper's Ferry, that was about the last time, that white people can refer to where anybody had a concerted effort to kill them.
Right, so, outside of maybe the Civil War. But yeah.
Well.
But that was white-on-white crime, to use the old horrible cliche.
Right. And my whole thing is, if black people were as violent as a lot of these white folks fear, a lot more of them would be dead by now. Yeah. I mean, that is not the case. And it is. It's open season. It's always been open season. When I was in college in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 30 years ago, a young man's larynx got broken with a nightstick, and the policeman threw him in the paddy wagon, and he choked to death on his own blood.
Oh,
no. I mean, this has been going on forever and ever. If they want to talk about statistics, if you really knew how many people have died, it would be ridiculous. And the bottom line, like I say, the best way to clear this law beyond legislation and everything else, if black folks started shooting white people the same way we've been shot, it would end overnight. That's going to be the quickest, easiest, best way, because I'm tired of walking slow and singing low, as my mother used to say.
Yeah.
You know, every funeral, how long do we need to legislate? How long do you need to do any of this stuff? You know, if his name was Jordan Soprano, I bet you we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Tony, excellent point. Thank you for making it. We're reaching a crisis point here in America. And to some extent, we're being pushed to that by the NRA and these corporations and these white racists who really want to, I was going to say bring back the old South, but it never really went away. It just, hang on just a second, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Just like Joe Madison says, Jim Crow has become James Crow ESQ. Tony, thank you for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sandra in Dallas, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air, Sandra.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate getting to talk to you. What's going on in our society right now is really overwhelming to me. I am 65. My mother is one of the women honored by Hillary Clinton for having gotten Central High open for the blacks, black students to enter. My family has fought in civil rights for generations. I spoke to my niece the other day who lives in Jacksonville, Florida, and I don't know what's happened to her during the years that she has lived there, but she has become a bigot during her time living there. She is totally on the other side.
She's white.
Issue. Yes, we're all white.
Mm-hmm.
My family for three generations has fought alongside the blacks for civil rights. And now my niece moves to Jackson. My mother died, who was the biggest civil rights leader in our family. And my niece moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And I spoke to her the other day, and she said everyone in Jacksonville is all upset about this mistrial. They think he should have just walked out of the courtroom. I said, what? She said, yes. She said, we have such a terrible problem with the blacks running around being thugs down here that we really are glad we have this Stand Your Ground law.
Wow.
And it just hurt me very deep. They actually have got a mentality that since they have this Stand Your Ground law, they don't have to deal with anyone different than themselves?
Well, it's almost like I'm sick and tired. It's like they're saying that they are sick and tired of listening to loud rap music, and now they have a legal justification for murdering people who inflicted on them. And isn't that cool? You know, if we do that enough, maybe people will stop with the loud rap.
Oh, Tom, you're one of the very few people on TV that I can listen to that speaks to my values and my heart and my mind. I called someone else in Arkansas, mm-hmm. and they made the comment that they've actually seen some blacks talking on TV that seem to be intelligent.
As if that's not possible? Incredulous?
As if they just woke up to that reality?
Oh, yeah.
Growing up in Arkansas with my family, like I said, we fought for civil rights. We had to, because my mother had black educational friends that had master's degrees and everything just like her, and they were fighting the fight, and well, for that matter, my grandfather raised me on a nursery rhyme. He woke me up every morning singing, "Wake up, old Willie, wake up. I know you're tired and you're sleepy too. I don't need you, but the white folk do."
Wow.
And the significance of that was how entrenched the battle was in our family.
Yeah.
I tell people I have white skin and a black heart.
Yeah. Sandra, thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. It's an extraordinary one. Thank you very much. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV down there in Dallas, Texas. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing. Amazing what is going on. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto. Welcome to the program.
Tom, first of all, hi. And I just wanted to make a commentary. I listened to what I believe his name is Armin said,
yeah.
One of your first callers.
Yeah.
And what he said convinces me now more than ever of how deeply divided the working class in this country is against themselves and against their own interests.
Especially the white working class.
I have never seen a nation where working class people, instead of standing up together, give in to racism. They give in to all sorts of right-wing conspiracy theories. And they have this kind of love-hate relationship with capitalism where they gripe about it and complain about it, but then they easily support the interests of the wealthy. I got to tell you, I'm more convinced of that now more than ever, and this is why we're not making any progress, whether it's on income inequality or the control that corporations have over our government. The lack of labor union rights for working people, and we can go down the line. If the working class in this country does not unify together across racial lines, across occupations, across regions, and just work together as one, man, the kind of political force that they will be in this country to change things will be nothing that capitalism could ever put against them at all.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying that a good example, what happened in the Volkswagen plant over the weekend. How could 712 workers easily believe the threats and the conspiracy theories of Republican politicians?
They believe them because they came from their governor and their senator. I mean, you expect these people to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I know, but I'm guaranteed that being that it's Tennessee, and I'm here in the South, I can tell you, so many working class and poor people already believe in the talking points of the right wing,
yeah.
And end up voting against their own interests.
Let me lay some of this out here for you, Umberto, and get you can share your take on this. Professor Andrew Oswald of the University of Warwick, Professor Nick Podavy of the London School of Economics and Melbourne University. did what they say is the first study of its type that's ever been done. The title of the study is Does Money Make People Right-Wing and Inegalitarian? Colon, a longitudinal study of lottery winners. And what they did was they went out and they found lottery winners. They got the information this is all in the UK, from the UK office of, you know, lottery winners or whatever. And what they found, the authors say it's the first research of its kind. The study uses information on thousands of people and lottery wins up to around the equivalent of US $300,000. The authors believe their paper has wide implications for how democracy works. Professor Oswald said he was doubtful of the view that morality was an objective choice. He said, in the voting booth, monetary self-interest casts a long shadow, despite people's protestations that there are intellectual reasons for voting for low tax rates. He said, it seems that having money causes people to favor conservative right-wing ideas. Humans are creatures of flexible ethics. And basically what they found is that the more money somebody won in a lottery, the more to the right their politics went. People who won very little, their politics stayed broadly to the left or to the center. But as people actually got wealthy, their politics went to the right. Now, extend that logic just a little bit, and I would say that over the last 30 years, since the era of Reaganomics, the celebration of the wealthy, you know, when, you know, Jimmy Carter had a people's ball, Reagan had the, you know, the billionaire's ball, since we started celebrating great wealth in this country, and it started showing up on TV in the 80s. We went from the old, you know, Jackie Gleason, Lucy Ball, an apartment looking, and Dick Van Dyke looking like the middle class, to the Murphy Browns and on forward, you know, Dynasty, you know, everybody's house is worth $1 million or $10 million. And it's like what has happened is that working people have been taught to identify with wealthy people and adopt their values, even though they themselves are not wealthy. And those are the people who are voting against their own best interests. Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, actually, you answered one big thing, and that is that in this country, so many people have been indoctrinated to believe that it is better to be wealthy and to try to, you know, scrape your way up to the 1%, to become part of the 1%, instead of unifying with other members of your own economic and social class, for example, unifying with the rest of the working class, and in that way struggling, whether it's through politics or through a social movement, a mass social movement, towards creating a much more equal society. Now, people would much rather, you know, live the lifestyles of the rich and famous, or hope that one day they would, you know, live that kind of life, instead of saying, you know, I want an equal society. I want a just society, and I'm going to struggle with others of my same, you know, economic and social class to make that happen. I don't see that in this country. I mean, I hope that we can awaken the working class so that they can stop dreaming and stop being so distracted, but that's what I see right now.
Yeah, well, I think this is the answer to, and I think it's what What's the Matter with Kansas, was groping toward, you know, is how is it that average working people and even the working poor vote in the interests of the wealthy? And I think it's because the value system of the wealthy since the 1980s has become the ascendant value system in the United States. And that's the value system that votes Republican. And I'm not talking values like, you know, gay marriage or not, or something like that. I'm simply talking about the idea of the aspirational values. Yes, I too can become rich someday. This is the great American. It's not really the American dream. The American dream is to be the middle class. It's the American fantasy. And in fact, it is harder now for someone born in the bottom 20% to hit the top 20% than it has been in 100 years. Thank you, Alberto, for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, You say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Tim Cavanaugh on the line with us, the news editor of the National Review. NationalReview.com is the website. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. The Comcast Time Warner deal is, I've not seen any reporting that indicates that there's going to be a serious debate about this in the Justice Department's antitrust division. And yet, increasingly, it seems to me that the Internet is, or certainly has been, since it was invented by our government and developed by the military and our university system, and then propagated out to people all over the country in a variety of ways, first as CompuServe and AOL, and then as the World Wide Web, that it's part of our information commons. Would you agree with that premise to start out the conversation?
No, I wouldn't. Are we going to talk about them as cable companies or in their capacity as ISPs? Because in there's a big difference in how much of the market these folks control over cable.
Right.
I have no love for Comcast or Time Warner. I've been a customer of both and can't stand them. But the cable is really a dying medium.
Right.
And in terms of internet service providers, we still have at least a dozen companies around the country with more than a million customers in ISP. And there's actually much more flourishing competition in ISP providing than there is just in cable. And I'll speak to my own case because I don't think I'm any smarter than anybody else out there. I moved 2 years ago, didn't turn on cable, and the more time goes by and the more I continue to I haven't suffered any loss really in my media diet that I've noticed. I don't know that I'm ever going to sign up for cable again. And, the same way that at some point I moved and didn't turn on the landline, and now, nobody has a landline phone anymore. So I don't really.
No, I agree with you that that's the trend, and that's the thing that concerns me is.
There is an issue maybe about how big these guys are, although they're not near monopoly in terms of 100%.
Well, let me ask you a question, Tim. What do you define as a competitive marketplace? I mean, in France, you can choose from over 100 different ISPs. And so and dozens of different cable companies and dozens of different and maybe closer to 100. I don't know, but it's certainly dozens of different cellular providers, telephone providers. And it's all carried over the same copper. And so you have a very competitive market. So as the New York Times pointed out, for about $35 a month, you get 150 channels of cable TV. You get 100 MIP download, 50 MIP upload broadband, plus you get cell phone service to 38 countries.
The reality is that we have, our media diets are much richer at a lower price now than they were even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years.
No, but how do you define competition? I mean, my experience has been both as a frequent flyer, in the airlines and in other things, that if there's only four or five companies dominating a marketplace, it's not a competitive marketplace.
Comcast and Time Warner are certainly not companies I would define as products of the free market. I mean, these are companies, both of these are intimately involved with the government at all levels. One of the reasons you've mentioned that there's not going to be a lot of debate about this in antitrust is that they're huge contributors to the Democrats.
Right.
So,
and to the Republicans.
You're not going to see a presidential executive and a Democratic executive branch doing a lot to discount.
No, I'm totally with you. I mean, the Citizens United, Buckley Vallejo, First National Bank, these Supreme Court decisions that found that the First Amendment protects money and the 14th Amendment protects corporations have done insane damage to our political process. I'm totally with you, Tim, on that. We're talking with Tim Cavanaugh, the news editor of National Review.
Wait a second. We are in a far less monopoly telecommunications world than we were back before any of those decisions.
Yeah, back, I mean, it was Nixon who decided that he was going to break up AT&T because it was a violation of the antitrust laws.
Okay.
It was Carter who finally, closed the deal.
Back then you had three channels and you had one option on telephones. Now you have far more options. And if you're only looking,
the flip side of that, Tim, is that back,
to look at everything.
Back then, the TV stations were locally owned. The radio stations were locally owned. I used to work in radio and television. I worked for a TV station for a few months, but I worked in radio for 10 years in Lansing, Michigan. And the local TV station was WJIM. It was owned by a local family. They named it after their son, Jim. And, every radio or TV station in that town was owned locally. I don't think any of them are anymore. And every single one had its own news staff because they all had to provide real news in order to get their licenses renewed every year, which was the fairness doctrine. And Reagan blew that up in 87. So I would say that there was a time when we had a competitive news market.
I really think if we're saying in 1987 we had better options for news than we have now, I just think that's completely divorced from reality on planet Earth.
I'd say at the local level that was true. At the national and international level, I think you're right. Back then, if you wanted to get good news of what's going on in Europe, you'd probably have to tune into BBC or something like that. But back to this issue of competition, because we're not going to go back to 1980, and probably we shouldn't. But why not? Do this Solomonic thing. Why not cut the baby in half? Why not say, Time Warner, Comcast, you guys, you can do anything you want, but we're going to just pass this really, really simple rule that says that the people who control or who build the infrastructure, the copper, the fiber, the satellite, the microwave, they can charge their costs plus a reasonable profit for the use of that cable, but they have to open it up to anybody to be the actual provider of content. For example, when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont.
Neutrality argument?
This is not a net neutrality argument. This is not a net neutrality. When I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, the copper that came into our house was owned by Verizon because it had been owned by Bell, and one of the baby Bells had been bought up by Verizon when they reconsolidated. Verizon owned that copper, but Vermont had a law that said that just because you owned the copper, you couldn't restrict somebody from providing content. So my phone company was a little company called Sovereignet that was located four blocks from my house, and they provided probably a third of the telephone service in Montpelier. Flat rate, $25 a month. If you called the repair guy, he would walk over to your house. It was wonderful service, and it was over Comcast's copper. Now, they had to pay Comcast an access fee to that copper, and Comcast made a profit on it, or Verizon, rather. But if I wanted Verizon's phone, before Sovereignet started, Verizon was like $50 or $55 a month. When Sovereignet started, Verizon dropped their price. I don't know to what, because I went with Sovereignet. But then Verizon went to the legislature and said, let's pass a law making this illegal. We own the copper. We should be able to control what carries through it. Can you and I agree that we should make a rule that the extent of government regulation should be that even though you own the copper, you cannot be the only purveyor of information on that copper? In other words, Comcast is not necessarily your ISP, even though they own the copper coming into your house?
I don't know why. I mean, there are so many more options now than there used to be, including copper coming into your house. I mean, you're not limited to just one.
But it's the same thing. If you've got a Verizon stick, if you got a Verizon USB stick, you got to go with Verizon as your USB.
Let me talk for a second. You may well be limited in cable and cable traditional cable, coaxial television. Mm. But again, it's going away. I mean, that's not a booming market. It's not something that has a bright future before it. And internet access is the name of the game. That's where Netflix is getting. That's where they're streaming all of the coming ways of getting content out there have nothing to do with people. And there's
yeah.
competition there.
I agree with you, Tim. You know, Tim Cavanaugh, nationalreview.com. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom. Great talking to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Should Time Warner and Comcast be allowed to merge? And the larger issue, should we change the paradigm of the business model? That and more in just a second. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Greeley, Colorado. Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just put an example out to this lady that if I'm walking down the street, I'm a Mexican, and I see a Caucasian with a red shirt, and I go up to him and I say, please remove your shirt, it's hurting my eyes. And he says, hell no, it's my shirt. So I tell him, remove your shirt or you're going to pay for it. So he refuses to tear off that shirt, so I shoot him. Isn't that to coincide with the case in Florida, because you don't like music?
Well, no, because this guy is not asserting that he shot the kid because of the music. He's asserting that he shot the kid because he saw something that he believed to be a gun, and that provoked him to fear for his life. Now, you could to take that red shirt analogy, you could say the guy's walking down the street with a red shirt and he's got, you know, a can of soda pop under his shirt because it's a hot day and he's trying to cool off his stomach or something, and you think it's a gun. And so you shoot him because you think he's armed or he goes for his can of pop or something like, you know, we're mangling this metaphor, but if somehow that red shirt can cause you to think that he is a threat to you, then in one of those 20 some odd states where there's these stand your ground, shoot first laws in place, you would have the legal right based on your fear, your perception of danger. Not the actual danger, but your perception of danger, you would have the legal right to kill him.
Well, I was sitting in the restaurant, and I got stabbed by a Caucasian person, and we went to court about that, and he went free. They didn't charge him with anything. And I said, you know, am I allowed to go into a restaurant and eat and just be left alone, or am I going to be threatened because of the color of my skin?
Did this guy stab you because you were Hispanic?
Yes.
Did he say so?
No, he just says, what do you expect doing in this restaurant?
That's what he said to you?
Yeah. I said, well, what's the deal here? Am I allowed to eat or do I have to go to another restaurant?
Right. Was this presented to a jury, Paul, or was it before a judge?
It was just before a judge.
And was And was the judge white?
All the judges in Greeley are white. So, you know, that leans towards the white defendant.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering that stand your ground law,
it does not cut both ways. That's the problem. And Paul, I think that's you're making a great point, you know, about that this law does not cut both ways. This law, the stand your ground, shoot first law, you have to demonstrate that you're legitimately afraid.
How do you do that?
Yeah, try convincing, if you're Hispanic, try convincing a jury that somebody made you afraid simply because they were white and walking down the street. You're going to have a hard time doing it. But apparently it is possible to convince a jury, that, you know, in the case of Trayvon Martin, that you're afraid because somebody's black and they're carrying a can of pop and a bag of Skittles. And, you know.
Florida is an armed camp against the minorities.
I think so. I think so. Paul, thanks for sharing your story. It's a remarkable one. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. So here we have Mr. Michael Dunn, who broke up with his wife years ago, has a bad relationship with his son, described as a failed father-son relationship, goes to his son's wedding, according to some reports, slammed down a handful of drinks and left early, stopped so his lady could get more alcohol and chips. This is from the H2O Man post over at DU. Got PO'd at some teenagers disrespecting him, got out his gun, then fled the scene. He was convicted, as Joe Madison pointed out, he was convicted of shooting at the car. That was called attempted murder. I mean, you could say he was convicted of shooting at the other teenagers in the car. But the one teenager that he actually killed hung jury. Somebody held out on this thing saying, no, I will not vote for a conviction. Why? We don't know. I mean, you know, maybe that juror will come forward and explain to us why. The question I have is, the question I would ask that juror is, do you feel afraid for your life when a car full of African-American kids plays loud music sitting next to you, or particularly if one of them starts yelling at you after you've yelled at them? I mean, would you feel afraid for your life? And A, which actually meets the legal test in Florida for your right to kill somebody because of the stand your ground, shoot first laws brought to you courtesy of ALEC and the NRA. But secondly, would you have felt the same way if that car was full of white kids and they were talking back to you? This is about Michael Dunn feeling entitled to kill a young African American. And I can tell you, as a white person who lives in a city that's got, I think it's the D.C. is now about 50-50. My neighborhood where I live, in the marina where we live, it's probably 95% white, 5% African-American. But the neighborhood around it is probably 50-50. And two blocks away is the beginning of about a half a mile of projects, which is virtually 100% African-American. And so there's a lot of mixing and churning and whatnot. And one of the first things I noticed when I moved to Washington, D.C. was because, I mean, when we lived in Atlanta, we lived in the white suburbs. I lived in Vermont and New Hampshire, which are both very, very white states. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, in a white part of town. I've known people. I've had friends and acquaintances and coworkers who were people of color, but I've never lived in a mixed neighborhood before. And one of the things that I noticed was that I've never felt threatened. 3 years in this city, I've never felt threatened. In fact, what I find is that people of color are extraordinarily courteous. And I was puzzling on this until one day about 2 years ago. Louise and I are out to dinner with Joe and Sherry Madison. Joe, the African-American talk show host. And, I mean, we're just having dinner and talking about this stuff. And Joe makes this comment about the conversation that he had to have with each one of his children about how to react when you're out in the world if the police show up. And how this is the story that every African-American family has to tell always tell their children. And that the net of it all is that a white, you know, as a black person, I don't want to put words in Joe's mouth, so I'll just tell you my understanding of what he was saying. That many black people feel that a white person could kill them with no, you know, with impunity, with no punishment or with minor punishment. But that if they were to kill or even assault a white person and get caught for it, they would spend lots and lots of time in jail or worse, or far worse. And so there's actually a fear of white people by blacks, which white people are unaware of. If I'm making any sense here, I think this is real. But being white, I don't know. I mean, I think I know. But what I do know is that the African Americans that I encounter in my neighborhood, I go to Safeway, you know, we go shopping, we go on the week, we hang around there. Very nice, very polite. And I don't think it's because they're afraid that I can kill them and get away with it, although that is the reality that they all have to live with. And it's like, wow, you drill down to that level and you really get what white privilege is all about. Or at least one piece of what white privilege is all about. And you get these white people who say, well, there's no National Association for the Advancement of White People. Well, you know, white people don't live every day feeling that somebody else can kill them and probably get away with it. And then you get stories like Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis. And what does that say to every black teenager in America? Look out. But not just every black teenager. Every person of color. I mean, and Paul, the caller who just called a few minutes ago, who was Hispanic, and he said he was in Greeley, Colorado, and he's sitting in a restaurant, and a white guy says, "What are you?" And he uses the S word, the slur for Hispanics. He says, "What are you guys? What are you doing here?" And Paul said, "What? I can't sit in this restaurant." And the guy stabbed him. Police show up. It goes to trial. The judge throws it out. And Paul is like, "What? I guess I can't eat in the restaurant." It's like, welcome to America. And then to make this really and truly bizarre, the prosecution, both in the Michael Dunn case and in the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case, the Jordan Davis, Michael Dunn, Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, in neither case did they introduce the issue of race, which I think is at the core of both of these.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How is a white person in a black neighborhood carrying a gun any different than a white person 200 years ago or 100 years ago in a black neighborhood carrying a noose? And the very, very corrigibly ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Dale Hansen, the Texas sportscaster, is earning praise all around the country this week for his epic on-air takedown of the people who say that the NFL isn't ready for an openly gay player like Michael Sam. Check it out.
You beat a woman and drag her down a flight of stairs, pulling her hair out by the roots. You're the fourth guy taken in the NFL draft. You kill people while driving drunk. That guy's welcome. Players caught in hotel rooms with illegal drugs and prostitutes. We know they're welcome. Players accused of rape and pay the woman to go away. You lie to police trying to cover up a murder. We're comfortable with that. You love another man. Well, now you've gone too far. It wasn't that long ago when we were being told that black players couldn't play in our games because it would be uncomfortable. It is not our differences that divide us. It is our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences.
Well said. Let's hope Dale knocks some sense into the bigots of the sports world. The bad. Culpeper County Sheriff's Office. The Virginia Law Enforcement Agency is under fire this week for hiring John Guandolo to host a three-day training session. Guandolo, a former FBI agent, looks, on paper at least, to be the perfect fit for the sheriff's office training needs. The only problem is he's a conspiracy nut and a total Islamophobe. He believes that CIA Director John Brennan is a Muslim agent and has said that Muslims do not have a First Amendment right to do anything. Let's hope that the Culpeper County Sheriff's Office didn't know about Guandolo's past when it chose him to teach a safety class. Because if it did and hired him anyway, that would send a terrible message to the Muslims of Culpeper County. And the very, very ugly, the Sunday shows. NBC is facing criticism today for hosting a debate about climate change between Bill Nye the Science Guy and Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn during yesterday's broadcast of Meet the Press. While hosting a debate on something 97% of scientists say is a fact is questionable enough, NBC isn't the only bad guy here. Sunday shows as a whole do a terrible job talking about climate change. A recent Media Matters study found that they talked about climate change for a total of 27 minutes in all of 2013. That's right, the major Sunday shows talked about the greatest threat our species has ever faced for less than half an hour during the entire last year. That is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Catherine in Sacramento, California. Catherine, welcome to the program. You wanted to get in on this conversation about Jordan Davis, Michael Dunn.
Yes. First, I want to say that I just love your program. I think I've learned a lot.
Thank you.
But I got very upset. I didn't really understand the point. But when the man was talking to you about where you live and whether you would walk through that neighborhood where the projects are.
Right, right.
And so he, so I just had to call in.
Yeah.
And share my story because I've always lived in a white neighborhood. I'm a very pale Caucasian woman. Mm-hmm. And when I was in my early 50s, I started to become disabled, and now I'm almost 70. So I've lived in an all-black neighborhood, pretty much black neighborhood, for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did it, you know, I adore houses that are like those 1930s bungalows,
yeah,
we would call them. And so there was a neighborhood that had a lot of these really cute houses. And I had a lot of animals, and my choice was get rid of all the animals, move in an apartment, or I could move into this cute little 30s bungalow, keep all my animals, and live in an all-black neighborhood, basically black neighborhood. So I chose to move into the cute little bungalow. And, of course, I didn't know for sure what would happen, and I did have a very close friend. I had never really lived around black people, but I had a very close friend. And before I moved in, I had already made the decision, but before I moved in, I did say to her, how do you think I will be treated when I move there? And she said, I think they will be very protective of you.
Hmm.
So anyway, so I moved in, and right away, the woman across the street came over and introduced herself to me and said hello and everything. And, you know, and then as I was here, I got sicker and sicker and things, and I got to know neighbors right away. They just have all been friendly. And I ended up needing a lot of help. And I have just never seen such helpful people. And I do know that if I had stayed in that nice neighborhood I was in Sonoma County, that I would have never found this kind of help. And I don't have any family here at all. I have a daughter, but she lives mostly in Wisconsin. So I'm here all by myself, but they have been so, and this is really true. I mean, that's absolutely true. The people across the street, they've got keys to my car and my house, and they can just totally take care of me if something bad happens.
Yeah.
And
I draw two lessons out of this. The first is that regardless of the color of our skin, we're all just human beings here. I mean, you know, which is the almost cliched, so obvious, but a lot of people miss it. The other is this theory I've been developing since I've lived in a marina. About once a year, somebody in our marina will slip and fall into the water and die. A woman died just a few months ago. And because the water is so cold that you just, you know, you hypothermia and you just die. And if Hurricane Sandy had turned west 6 hours earlier, we would have all been splinters. And I think that the close and our community, I mean, every Sunday morning there's on somebody else's boat or in the public area, everybody gets together and there's like this real community that has formed where people know each other and pitch in and help out. And it's really quite remarkable. And I'm convinced that the closer you live to death or the closer you live to real survival stuff, the tighter your community becomes. And because that's just like humans gathering together against the wind, you know, whereas when we lived in a hoity-toity upper middle class, fancy schmancy Atlanta suburb, I didn't know any of my neighbors ever in the 5 years we lived there. I didn't know the names of the people on either who owned the houses on either side of me. I don't to this day. And so, you know, being part of a group, an oppressed minority. And again, I realize it sounds like a cliche, but I think it's not. It sounds like there's real community there.
Right. Yeah, that does make sense because they've had to stick together to survive through the ages, because I would find black people to just be a lot nicer and a lot easier to get to know. And it's been a wonderful experience here, and with the church as well that I went to.
Yeah.
So, and I think anybody that's, if they want to just find out a few things, you know, get to know some people and go to a black church.
Yeah.
When I first went to the black church, I wondered what would happen. You know, I didn't know whether they would really like me very much, and it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just, and so obviously for me, it makes me very sad that I see the racism.
Yeah, well, and I think that reaching out is happening.
They treated Obama, things like that. It's just very, very, really sad. And, you know, I hope that we get through it someday.
I do, too. And I think that reaching out is happening more and more. You know, there's a few African-American families who live in our marina, and I think people, you know, go out of their way to reach out. Well, people reach out to everybody. It's just, it's like color is, other than for the Michael Dunns of the world, you know, it's almost like we're becoming two Americas, an America that's super paranoid about color, and an America that is saying, you know, let's move on to a conversation about how do we raise everybody into the middle class again and get back to the American dream and that kind of thing. Catherine,
problems, don't we?
Yeah, there you go. Catherine, thanks so much for sharing your story with us and listening in Sacramento. I really appreciate it. It was a great, great conversation. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I would say to Catherine that I don't think she's really alone. If she exchanges keys with her neighbors, they have each other's keys and help each other out. That's what family does.
Yeah.
So, by definition, she's not alone. She's got family.
Yeah.
She's
well, when we lived in Vermont, which is a much smaller community, and you've got the I mean, literally a winter storm you can lose power for a week and you have to depend on each other. We had neighbors who had access to our house continuously and vice versa. So, which goes back to my theory that the closer you live.
I also share that in my neighborhood of 18 to 22 houses, I was doing a mental check while waiting, holding on the line, and I realized about 9 of the 18 to 22 houses are people of color.
Right.
And they're all, you know, they're all quiet. They have families. They're hardworking middle-class folks. We have people up at the corner on the parallel street that rent out these big blow-up, you know, fan-driven castles for their kids to hop around in, and they have Cajun band playing live music every birthday for their kids. We have a mixed race couple a few houses down. This is the kind of neighborhood you want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, increasingly,
anyway,
this is the face of America, and it's interesting that the show is kind of becoming, you know, white people talking about discovering that we're all just people here, but it's
and finally, Tom.
Yeah.
The last thing I would do on the same theme, I think what we're ready for in the White House is to have a black president who's really black, someone who's smart but with an attitude like Chris Rock. He doesn't take any don't take any crap from white folk Republicans.
Yeah. If Barack, you know, this is the very, very delicate line that President Obama has to walk, though. I mean, he used the word damn on television once, and for weeks Fox News and Drudge was going after him for it. It's a tough one, Johnny. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's the extent to which those look out for the scary black man racial stereotypes get triggered in the white community. It's bad stuff. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Eddie in Knoxville, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Eddie, what's up?
Hey, I listened to your show a few days ago, and you were talking about companies that internalize the profits and export the cost, you know, into the public sector.
Right, externalize the costs, yeah.
Right, thank you. And I was noticing, you know, you were talking about oil companies, fast food restaurants, and I'm just working under an assumption. You wouldn't advertise for those types of companies. I mean, BP, McDonald's, that kind of thing.
There are two kinds of ads that we do on this show. One is an endorsement ad, which is where I'm reading the ad, and the other is just, you know, they buy time. And you know, I'm fairly careful about who I endorse. If you're going to get into any individual advertisers on our program, I'm going to ask you to stop right now, because I don't want to do that.
I'm just saying, for me, I mean, you glanced over as a child of an adult child of an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
alcohol companies, beer, liquor, wine, they externalize huge amounts of cost.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we charge a large tax. First of all, I have no alcohol advertisers, so I got no dog in this fight. Oh, I do. EcoWine. That's right. We do have an alcohol advertiser, and actually, I use and endorse their products. So, okay. But we tax alcohol suppliers in the United States in order to recapture those externalities. We don't do that with oil. I would not have as much of a problem with oil if we had done like Denmark. I mean, Denmark actually calculated the number of cancers that burning gasoline caused in that country. And they said, okay, you know, we have a national healthcare system. We all pay for it with our tax dollars. And we're getting X number of thousands of cancers a year because of gasoline. And so we're going to add the cost of treating that number of cancers and certain number of cases of asthma and whatever. We're going to add that to the gas. And they were real early on with the gasoline tax in Europe, specifically to capture externalities. It's something that we have done with tobacco. We have done, I don't think well enough, but we have done with tobacco. We have done with alcohol. We've not done with oil.
For me, it all really boils down to, and I mean, and this, you know, as someone who listens occasionally, I mm-hmm. don't often agree, but I do listen.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the whole thing with the fast food, with anything, it's by going after those companies and saying, you know, well, your product does this. Any product eaten or drank or anything to excess is going to cause problems that someone has to pay.
No, my concern about McDonald's and Walmart has nothing to do or very little to do with the product they're selling. It has to do with the fact that they pay such low wages that their workers are eligible for public benefits. So we're subsidized. They've developed a business model that's based on the assumption that their workers qualify for food stamps.
Right, but you were discussing on the show I was listening to the externalizing of the overweight, the obese, the health issues as
right.
well.
Right, sure.
The way they pay is a whole other.
Yeah, well, we don't tax McDonald's and we don't tax Coca-Cola for the obesity that they cause. And I think that you could build a good case for doing so. You'd have to quantify it first, and we're just beginning to do the science on that. Eddie, thanks for the thoughtful conversation, even if you don't agree with me most of the time. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, and Neil in Wellington, Florida. Hey, Neil, you wanted you have some additional data on stand your ground laws to share?
Yes. The Tampa Bay Times newspaper had an article that I'd read, and I just looked up their website, and they have an interactive website where you can look at all the data from cases in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that there have been, you can actually look at the accused versus the victim. And for the white accused person, black victim, there have been 7 cases adjudicated, 1 conviction, 6 acquittals.
Okay.
For a black accused person, white victim, 7 cases again, this time 3 times more likely to be convicted, 3 convictions, 4 acquittals.
Mm-hmm.
And what's also interesting is in this, the original article said that actually white people have been the victim of, white on white has been the biggest number of cases.
Well, it's because most of the people in Florida are white.
Yeah, that is true. That's true.
And most of the gun owners in Florida are white.
Yep, that is true too. But the cases don't get as much publicity because they don't rise the profile. But
right.
You know, people have voted for their politicians, get them these. We got this, you know, stupid legislature here in Florida, and the people who voted for them, 60 of them are dead now.
Yeah.
And it's about a 50-50 chance of getting convicted or not.
Right.
For the white on white crime. So
fascinating.
As far as this Michael Dunn guy, I think the hung jury was because they went for a premeditated murder.
No. Well, first degree murder does require premeditation, but it can be premeditation that lasts a minute. I mean,
that's yeah. I don't know the legalities of it, but
yeah.
It seemed like just, you know, maybe there's a problem with it was 10 seconds of escalation, and is that premeditated versus you went out looking to kill somebody, which would certainly be premeditated, but I think that was the reason the hung jury was that,
yeah.
that premeditated.
Can you put yourself on the air?
For second degree, then maybe.
Shano, who used to live in Florida and is a law school graduate, wants to weigh in here. Our associate producer, Shane Farnan.
Hey there. The one thing about Florida is that lesser included offenses are always included. So if you charge first, they could have put him a second degree on him. Does that make sense?
So in other words, he was charged with first degree murder, and the jury had the option of saying, we're going to reduce this to second degree murder. In other words, murder without premeditation, but with malice. And they chose not to do that because they were hung.
Right.
Okay.
I see.
Okay. All right. Neil, thanks a lot for the call. Very interesting statistics. Stefan in Stockholm, Sweden. Really? Hey, Stefan.
Yeah. Hello, Tom. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much. It says you're watching on TomHartmann.com on our web stream. Do I have that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So what has provoked your curiosity?
I absolutely love it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling from Sweden. What's up?
You know, I follow American politics very closely, and I think it's very interesting because it differs so much to Swedish politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to know, when you talk about the representative house and the house of... You have this all these houses, and I don't understand the difference. What do you vote in all these different houses?
You're talking about the House of Representatives versus the Senate, or Congress versus the House of Representatives? Is this just a semantic question?
All the houses there, the House of Representatives and the Congress, and what is the difference, and is the conclusion when they vote in all these different houses.
Okay, here's just, you know, actually, thank you for the call, Stefan. A lot of people actually, you know, here's government 101, okay? Whether that was a serious question or not, it provokes a good answer. Number one, in the United States, we have a bicameral legislature. There's two branches of the legislature. There's the House of Representatives and there's the Senate. Members of the House of Representatives are elected every 2 years. Senators are elected every 6 years. Although every 2 years, one-third of the Senate is up for re-election. The president is elected every 4 years, but he's not part of the legislative. So the legislative branch, the Constitution says that all taxing and spending legislation and war powers legislation has to originate in the House of Representatives. It has to be closest to the people. When you refer to the House, you're referring to the House of Representatives. When you refer to Congress, you could be referring to the House of Representatives. I mean, arguably and technically, you should be referring to the Congress of the two, because Congress is a word that means joined, in its root form. And so that would be the House and the Senate. So Congress has to approve it before the president can sign it. It has to go through the House first, then it goes through the Senate. If there's a difference between the two pieces of legislation, at the end of the day, it goes back to what's called a conference committee, where the Speaker of the House or the Leader of the House appoints members of the House, the Leader of the Senate appoints members of the Senate. They sit together in a room and they work out a compromise piece of legislation that both bodies then are voting on identical bills. And if it passes both of them again, then only in an identical fashion, then that gets to the Senate, to the president for his signature. So if that's what you're talking about. Now, in addition, each state has their own legislative form. Some states are bicameral. There's a couple states that are unicameral. They have one single body that is the legislative body. Very often it's called a state assembly or words like that. In California, you have a state assembly and you have a state senate. Their assembly would be considered the House of Representatives in Michigan, where they've got a House of Representatives and a Senate. So it varies from state to state, and that seems to be whatever the language of the day that was very in when those states joined the Union and wrote their Constitution. Some states, about a third, maybe almost half of the states in the United States, adopted mostly around 1900, plus or minus 10 years of 1900, adopted the ability of the citizens to amend the constitutions of the state or to even pass laws. These are called citizens' referendums. That's not legal at the federal level. We can't do that for the entire country, but there are many states that can do that, so that happens. And in fact, marijuana got legalized in both Colorado and Washington State. In both those states, the members of the House and Senate of those two states were too cowardly to pass legislation decriminalizing pot, so the citizens did it themselves. So it didn't even involve a Congress or a House, or a Senate. So I hope I've answered your question, whether it was tongue-in-cheek or not. We'll be right.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, we could be, well, first of all, you know, just some of the stuff we've covered in the last 2 hours of the program, this whole Michael Dunn, Jordan Davis, race relations in the United States, Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman now saying he's a victim of the President of the United States and the Attorney General. Seriously, I'm not making that up. Some fascinating conversations. I've been hearing from white people living in African American neighborhoods and black neighborhoods. Heard from a Hispanic fellow who was stabbed by a white guy for being Hispanic in a restaurant, and how dare you? And the judge said, you know, tough luck. We're not going to prosecute this white guy. I mean, this is in Colorado even. And so it's been an interesting conversation all day long. It's you know, from Joe Madison was on our program, and along with Neil McCabe at different times talking about this topic. And we've been talking about we talked briefly about the Comcast merger. I see this as the beginning of the end of the internet, at least as we know it. But I'm also concerned about the beginning of the end of our economy as we know it, or not so much the economy, but the what used to be known as the American dream, also known as the middle class. And increasingly the American dream has become the American dream instead of the American dream of our the last 200 years pre-1980. It's become the American dream of the post-1980, the post-Reagan Revolution American dream, which is, you know, hitting the lottery, basically. And, you know, the working people in this country have just been wiped out. I mean, we could be flying high with the Jetsons, but instead we're stuck hoofing it with the Flintstones. Back in 1966, Time magazine published an article that looked ahead toward the future and discussed what the rises in technology and automation and computers and all. What's all this stuff going to mean for working class Americans? I mean, from the time of George Washington until the presidency of Ronald Reagan, with a few blips for wars, as American workers became more productive, their wages went up or their working hours went down or both. We went from 60-hour work weeks and poverty wages in the early 19th century to the 50-hour work week at the turn of the 20th century with better wages to solidly middle-class wages and a 40-hour work week by the 1950s. Whether it was the steam revolution of the early 19th century, the industrial revolution of the late 19th century, or the machine revolution of the early 20th century, as workers were able to make more things, in other words, be more productive, and create greater profits for their companies using fewer man hours or woman hours, fewer labor hours, the workers shared in the prosperity that was produced by their increased productivity. So much so that Time magazine simply assumed that from 1966 to the year 2000, as computer and advanced mechanization made American workers more productive, that our wages would go up and our work week would go down. This article in Time magazine back in 1966, let's step into the Wayback Machine here. The author of this article in 1966, looking out almost 40 years, 34 years, looking out at the year 2000, they said, and I quote, by 2000, the machines will be producing so much that everyone in the U.S. will, in effect, be independently wealthy. With government benefits, even non-working families will have, by one estimate, an annual income of $30,000 to $40,000. How to use leisure meaningfully will be a major problem. That's $30,000 to $40,000 in 1966 dollars. That's like $215,000 to $288,000 in today's dollars. And it wasn't just Time magazine predicting such a luxurious future for America. Back in the 60s, it was a commonly held belief that the rise, and our cartoons reflected it, you know, the Jetsons, that the rise of technology and automation would mean increased productivity in America, which in turn would mean more money and fewer hours worked for American workers. I mean, after all, it had always been that way in this country. So the rationale behind that belief was really simple. With increased technology, companies would be able to produce more and be more efficient on a per-worker basis. So their revenues would soar, their profits would be passed along to their workers who'd be making more and working fewer hours. And that's why back in 1966, everyone thought that by the year 2000, America would be the leisure society. They thought that our biggest worries would be how to use all of our time off, where to go on our many vacations, what sort of intellectual and artistic pursuits the middle class would choose to explore in the 21st century. Are we going to write poetry? Are we going to do music? But that logic all hinged on the top marginal income tax rate remaining at 70%, where it was in 1966. After CEOs had earned their first million or two, they started hitting that top tax bracket, and they simply stopped taking more pay. I mean, who wants to pay 70% income tax? Which is why, for about 50 years, CEOs earned about 30 times what their average workers earned, and no more. That high income tax rate encouraged CEOs to keep money in their businesses, to invest in new technology, to pay their workers more, to hire new workers so their businesses could expand. As businesses became more profitable, thanks to investments in automation and technology, workers saw more of those profits. They were shared with the employees, and they saw their standard of living and their leisure time go up. And Time magazine, back in 1966, assumed that that trend was going to continue right through to the beginning of the 21st century. How wrong they were. They did not see Ronald Reagan coming. Reagan came along, 1980s, slashed income taxes, and everything changed. The idea of the leisure society by the year 2000? Totally blown up. In 1981, Ronald Reagan introduced his Economic Recovery Tax Act, which cut the top marginal income tax rate from 70 to 50%, cut estate taxes for wealthy people and businesses, and slashed corporate profit and capital gains taxes. And just a few years later, Reagan again lowered the top income tax rate to 28%, a level that hadn't been seen since the early 1920s. And that low tax rate was, by the way, blamed by many economists for causing the bubble that led to the Great Depression. So how did the Reagan tax cuts doom today's working class Americans' opportunity for life, the life of leisure that Time magazine was foreseeing? When that Time article came out in 1966, working people's wages had stayed even with productivity levels since 1900. So people thought back then if productivity continued to rise, which was likely thanks to increases in automation and technology and computers, wages would rise. Thanks to Reagan, though, businesses did become more profitable, but there was less of an incentive to share the wealth. Because of historically low top income tax rates, CEOs pulled profits out of their companies and filled their Swiss bank accounts, all at the expense of working class Americans. So all these new profits that were created by automation, technology, you know, from the 1980s to today, 32 years of this stuff, 33 years of it. This was supposed to be shared with working people, giving us all higher paychecks and more time off. It instead went to the wealthy elite. Productivity continued to rise, but for the first time, wages stalled, and they've been stalled since 1980. Worker productivity continued to increase thanks to constant improvements in technology, but wages stayed flat. Working people's paychecks didn't increase, and neither did their time off. Back in the 50s, the average American worked 42 hours a week. Now, the average American working in manufacturing is working around 40 hours a week. And even though productivity has increased 400% since 1950, have wages gone up 400%? Nope, they've actually gone down. We should be able to work 10 hours a week right now and make the same pay that we were making in 1950, right?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, the Leisure Society was doomed the minute Ronald Reagan stepped into office, and we need to undo that by rolling back the Reagan tax cuts and Reaganomics. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And June in Shawano, Wisconsin, watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. June, you're on the air. What's you wanted to talk about unions?
I did, in a way. I want to ask you a question, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever read W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction?
No, I have not. I've read selected writings of his, but I've never sat down and read any of his writings all the way through. I'm sorry.
Well, in that particular book, as described by W.E.B. Du Bois, and he was very close in age to that era, they talked about the white and the black people in the South getting together to form a union.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Watson was the white man. And all of a sudden, it changed. The white Ku Klux Klan became active, and people who had money and knew better, the white citizens, said, no, can't do that. And
was this right around the turn of the 19th, around 1900, around the turn of the century?
It was closer to the period after the Civil War.
So you're talking about Reconstruction. Because the reason I was asking, have you seen the movie Birth of a Nation?
Yes.
Yeah, because that came out, I think, in 1903, and that became like the major recruiting thing for the re-energized, revitalized, reinvented Ku Klux Klan in the 19-teens. But
right.
Apparently we're talking about different eras. Okay.
Well, basically, it ended the existence of possible unions.
Mm-hmm.
This was the era of Eugene Debs.
Right.
And unfortunately, it didn't happen. And as one of your gentlemen talked about, why is this so? And I go back to this particular book, which I've read. And back to Catherine, I have been in her position, but that's because my husband was black.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a son who is mixed race.
And you live in an African-American community.
I lived there, and people took care of me.
Mm-hmm.
When we, at that point, the only place we could get to live, we lived in Evanston, Illinois, was to, with a black African couple.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I used to go, my baby was about, 3 months old, and we used to go to the laundromat, and everywhere people helped me. And walked me back, and everything was cool.
Yeah.
And my husband happened to be from Nigeria.
Hmm.
Unlike Barack Obama, was from the other side of the continent.
Right.
And he was a very successful man, and we both economists. Got along well, but unfortunately he died in 1991.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And we lost him, and my son was in the States, and I... Accurate. My mother-in-law died.
June, we have to wrap it up, but we have about 5 or 10 seconds. Is there a quick point you want to make? I think you did. I think you. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, June. It was wonderful. Thank you for sharing that, and I look forward to talking with you again. We'll be right back. So the United States won a gold in figure dancing, ice dancing, I guess they call it, and a bronze in the bobsled. So we're getting better. We're getting better. We're doing better. There's been some just, you know, Louise and I have watched some of the Olympics, mostly the ice skating stuff. It's just been breathtaking. I mean, the quality of these athletes is just extraordinary. David in Addison, Illinois. It says here you are angry and disgusted with me. Really?
Honestly, I mean, usually, Tom, I just disagree with you. But with this ridiculous racial narrative you're building into the Stand Your Ground law, this is just crossing the line. Like, I don't know if you're uninformed or deliberately misleading people, but let me start out with a couple stats. As far as Stand Your Ground goes in Florida, white people account for about half of the Stand Your Ground claims. Blacks account for about a quarter, little over a quarter. Whites are more likely to be found guilty when claiming Stand Your Ground than blacks are by 3 or 4%, and that's according to stats from Florida. Likewise, I think
we had an earlier caller who had very different statistics from yours, who said that
he was quoting the Tampa Times.
They rounded.
In general, a quarter of Stand Your Ground cases are claimed by blacks, where a black man or woman takes a gun or whatever and attacks someone else, and they are more likely to be found innocent. White people in general are more likely to be found guilty when claiming Stand Your Ground.
Well, could that be, David, because white people are more likely to be the aggressors in those kind of cases than blacks?
By 3 percentage points, yeah. However, in addition to that, the Tampa Times article also states, and Florida backs this one up, that black people are almost twice as likely as a white person when being the victim of a Stand Your Ground case to be carrying a gun, and not twice as likely, but much more likely to be committing a crime when someone defends themselves invoking Stand Your Ground. So I feel like to claim that there's any racial component, or as you've said repeatedly on this show, that Stand Your Ground is usually used for white-on-black violence, is not only incredibly disingenuous, but absolutely, that's just low.
I don't think I ever said usually, and if I did, I will retract that right now. But the fact of the matter is that in the Trayvon Martin case, in this Jordan Davis case with Michael Dunn, this was the defense, essentially, was I was afraid of the guy because he was black, and I therefore had a right to kill him.
No, it wasn't at all, and especially in the Trayvon Martin case, because I followed that, the race literally never came up in the case itself.
I know, and this is my problem with the prosecution. When you've got a guy who is saying on the phone, these people always get away with this, they're not going to get away with it this time, this guy isn't going to get away with it this time. You know, George Zimmerman was so clearly motivated by race.
That
should have been in the trial.
And that is chopping up quotes. Look, in that case, in the police audio, what happened was the police specifically asked him to further clarify, and that is the only time race was ever brought up by Zimmerman, and the "these people" quote was directly after he had spoken about people who were committing crimes in his neighborhood.
David, you know that that's not the case.
That is absolutely the case.
David, stop for a second. If a white kid wearing a hoodie had stopped and bought Skittles and iced tea and was walking home in that neighborhood, would George Zimmerman have been stalking him?
If he was wearing a hoodie and had his hands in his pockets in the middle of the rain for no apparent reason, I think he would have. And if that
have you ever been in the rain when you're wearing a hoodie? I mean, you put the top up.
Okay. No, I don't wear hoodies, actually. Suits.
Okay, well, I do. And, you know, and I have all winter. I've got a jacket that's got a hood on it. And yesterday, day before yesterday, it was raining here, and I was walking around with a hood up. And you know, it's just common sense. You don't want your head to get wet.
Please, look, Tom, the racial narrative that you and unfortunately a lot of people on the left have brought into these discussions are either a product of your failure to get any sort of action done on guns in any other way, because that's really what I think it is you're pissed off that you guys can't get guns banned in any other way, and every Supreme Court decision goes.
I don't want guns banned, David.
Tom,
I'm a sports shooter. I don't want guns banned.
You are so.
I want guns to be treated the same way automobiles are. Cars can kill people. Guns can kill people. They should be registered, insured, and users should be licensed. It's real simple. That's my position. I've always held that position.
the fact of the matter is, you and everyone else who holds that position has been woefully unsuccessful in convincing the Supreme Court and the U.S. government to do that. And instead of trying to, giving up and realizing you're wrong, or trying to pursue that in a reasonable way, what you've done is you've decided to take the nuclear option and inject race into the narrative where it really doesn't exist.
Now, race has been part of the narrative of this country, David, since it was founded.
But
if you deny that,
ridiculous. Statistically, it's not even a little over 5% of the cases in Florida even involve white on black violence. And for you to claim that that's a reason to evaluate,
as I said, I don't think I ever used the word majority or whatever the word was that you used.
I quote you here: "Stand your ground, lets white people walk around and kill black people. It's just like they had a noose."
Yes, I stand behind that. I see a straight line. What the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First law says is if you are afraid of somebody, you have the right to kill them. That was the old justification for lynching. These people are going to rape our white girls, and so we've got to teach them a lesson, or we've got to kill them, or we've got to stop them, and so let's lynch them. And now lynching is out of fashion, and shooting is in fashion. I stand behind that, David.
That's ridiculous. So you go from... it lets someone defend themselves when they feel threatened.
David, I have a feeling you have no idea, and I'm not asserting that I'm some sort of expert on this, but just no idea of what it must be like to be black in America.
I don't, but I do have an idea of what statistics are, and you're ignoring them. And what you're doing is, instead of looking statistically and reasonably at what's happening...
No, I'm saying that Stand Your Gun, Shoot First laws... rather than, the whole Castle Doctrine thing simply empowers people to act out their fears/prejudices.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because if fear, even if that fear is driven by prejudice, exists under the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws, that's a defense for murder. And it shouldn't be. Where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, I've had two callers today cite this Tampa Bay Times story. It's actually almost a year and a half old. The story was published on June 1st, 2012, by Chris Hundley, Susan Taylor Martin, and Connie Humberg, Times staff writers. The title of the article is Search the Stand Your Ground Case Files. And the subtitle, or maybe that's the section title, the title of the article, the headline, Florida Stand Your Ground Law Yields Some Shocking Outcomes Depending on How the Law Is Applied. It's got a lot of really fascinating stories in it. They point out in 2005, Jeb Bush signed this law into being. They don't get into the background. The background, which is fairly easy to track down, is that this is a law that was promoted by the National Rifle Association. It would increase the sale of guns and an extension of the so-called Castle Doctrine, that you can protect your home, only this is now your home becomes portable. You can go anywhere and protect yourself. You don't have an obligation to flee a situation. You may stand your ground and use deadly force if you feel threatened. To quote from the article, Darrell Payden, the former Republican senator from Crestview who sponsored the bill, said the law was never intended for people who put themselves in harm's way before they started firing. But the criminal justice system has been blind to that intent. So George Zimmerman put himself in harm's way by tracking Trayvon Martin after he'd been told not to by the police. Michael Dunn put himself in harm's way by not backing out when the kids talked back to him when he told them to turn down their car. To the extent that he was actually claiming that he was under threat, that he felt that he could be murdered. And here's the statistic, and this is on the first page of the article. Defendants claiming Stand Your Ground are more likely to prevail if the victim is black. 73% of those who killed a black person faced no penalty compared to 59% of those who killed a white. So I stand behind my noose versus gun metaphor. So, Tiffany. In Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Tiffany. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about black families, fear, and inequality?
Yes, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
I want to say that African American families, they teach their children not so much that they fear white people, but they fear the inequality associated with dealings with white people. Mm-hmm. And what I have found is those who are bigots, their main fear is equality. And I think you can correct me, but when Jim Crow came along, I think it was directly linked to equality.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Jim Crow was the response to Reconstruction, was it not?
And I believe so. And I think what happened is right after slavery, African Americans were doing so well that they needed to put some monkey wrench in there to reduce the equality that they were achieving.
Yes.
And even when you're looking at the cases with Trayvon Martin, purely that's just another form of inequality.
I don't know why. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say it's an inequality in the power relationship as opposed to the economic relationship.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's kind of scary to see, you know, where people's hearts are and where people's minds are. And I have to say, I applaud you for getting it. And I wish you would tell us how it is possible that you get it when so many other people just don't get it.
Well, I got to tell you, Tiffany, with some shame and embarrassment, that I didn't really get it at the level that I get it now, for the first 50 years of my life. You know, that until I lived in a mixed neighborhood and was just like, you know, race and racial conflict or the lack of it, frankly, was constantly present. You know, it's like most of my life, and I think this is the case with most white people in America, and it may well be the case with most black people in America, most of my life was spent predominantly with people of my own race. And right. So, I had intellectual constructs, and I understood the history, and I could cite you know, when Frederick Douglass died in 1895, but it was all intellectual. It didn't get real for me until I moved to D.C. This is the first time I've lived in an integrated community.
Wow. And I wish more people would get it, because people are just people. There's no need to fear. Everyone should do according to their own merits, and that's that. I think because so many African Americans right now are in positions that they never were, it's making more people become radical, and it's because of a fear of that inequality. And as America is changing, the demographic of America is changing, that is also perpetuating fear.
Yeah, that's Pat Buchanan saying that, you know, when last year or the year before, when we reached the point where there were more babies of color being born in America than white, that was the end of America. And I think that's that sentiment, that fear of equality that you so brilliantly identified, I think that's the sentiment that drives a lot of the whole birther thing, the anti-Obama stuff, the characterizing Obama with a bone in his nose and all this god-awful stuff, and the whole Duck Dynasty, it's like it's all code for, I think, as you correctly pointed out, after Reconstruction, the North Carolina legislature was taken by African Americans. There was a majority of African Americans, I believe.
Absolutely. People don't know that. Yeah.
And, well, but you know, it wasn't Du Bois. Who was the guy who made Birth of a Nation, the filmmaker? It was in that movie, which was like one of the most widely watched movies in the 1900s, which was this incredible racist characterization of the black folks who took over the North Carolina legislature, that they were sitting with their feet up on the desks and that they were just, you know, it was just this horrible thing. But it became this recruiting movie for the Klan. Have you ever seen Birth of a Nation?
I have not.
If you want to understand white fear and why the Klan rose in the early 20th century, it's a silent movie. It's about an hour and a half long, and you can't look away. It's so well done, and it is so racist and so awful, you know, from the perspective of us now, you know, 120 years later or 110 years later. But at the time it played, you could see where that movie not only energized the Klan and justified the decision that had happened in the Supreme Court just 5 years earlier, which was, 1898, help me out, Shano. That, you know, separate but equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. Not only did that movie give white people cause white people to say, oh, well, that was a wise thing that the Supreme Court did. We should separate the races and all that kind of stuff, and then lead to 60 years of legal apartheid in the United States. And not only did it do that, but it also, I think, just set the stage for this fear. Okay, we had this brief moment in time in the 1870s when there was equality of the races in a small part of America, in North Carolina. And basically the through line of the movie is, and everything went to hell as a result of it. And yeah. So, you know, so white folks were like, you know, we can't let that happen again. And that's, you know, it's something that, anyway, I'm blithering here, Tiffany.
I thank you for inspiring people to at least think and not take things at face value.
Thank you.
I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your kind words and your insightful comment. And for thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Darren in Long Beach, California. You're on the air, Darren.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I've been watching you on and off since I got DirecTV, and I never heard you say anything about gun control. So I would think that, you know, just from what you believe is that you would just be for the First Amendment, you know, within reason.
The Second Amendment, yeah. I've done that debate on TV a few times here, or on radio. There's a radio show that's been simulcast as TV. And I've been fairly consistent, I think, throughout most of my life. One of my three brothers is a very, very avid sports shooter. And when Louise and I go back to Michigan, and he lives out in a rural area, and he's got his own range, and we've gone to commercial ranges and stuff. And I love target practice, and I love skeet shooting. I don't like to kill animals. I've never done it. Have no desire to. But you know, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with people hunting as long as they eat what they kill. I mean, it's even though I'm a vegetarian, but I, you know, and the beginning and end of my thing on gun control is simple. It's two parts. One, I agree with the assault weapon ban that Ronald Reagan championed and was passed after he was shot. That weapons of war should not be in the streets of America, fully automatic weapons and things like that, or, you know, the weapons of war. Number one, you don't need them to hunt. You don't need them to target practice. That's not sportsman stuff. And you don't need them for self-defense, frankly. And number two, that we should treat guns the same way we treat cars. And I don't see this as any infringement on anybody's right. I have a right to own a car. But the state has a right to say you have to have that car insured in case you kill somebody with it. And, you know, if the shooter in Newtown had, you know, if we had this law, GEICO would be paying the victims $1 million apiece, and instead they're getting nothing. You have to have insurance, liability insurance. You have to have the gun registered, just like your car is registered, so you can always figure out where it came from and whose it was. And you have to have a license that demonstrates that you're competent. And the level for competence can be very low. You don't have to be a professional marksman. You just have to know how to handle a thing safely and know what a trigger guard is. You know, it's so, any or a trigger lock, excuse me. Darren, am I making sense here?
No.
Or have I gone over the top?
Yep.
Okay. Darren, we're out of time. I'm sorry. And I can't quite hear you. Your phone is faded out. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, I realize my position that guns should be insured and registered and all that is extreme to the max, and even Democrats won't touch it, but it seems to me like common sense. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Justine, listening to WBAI in Astoria, New York. Hey, Justine, what's up?
Well, I'd like to tie together a couple of points that you made and that one of the callers made. You know, you talked about how wages have gone down and how that was partly a result of what, you know, when Reagan changed the tax policies.
Right.
And about the your ground law. I know it sounds like, you know, two weird things to tie together, but mm-hmm. I think it was prompted by something that one of your callers said. You know, I grew up in a white blue-collar neighborhood, which, you know, in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and Paris specifically. And, you know, neighborhoods like that pretty much don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And all the men in my family were blue-collar workers. You know, some of them belonged to unions. And what happened, you know, I think was that when, you know, those jobs started to disappear, you know, and you know, the sons of those blue-collar workers, you know, including some of my family, realized that they weren't going to get those jobs that their fathers had, that their uncles had, that their grandfathers had. You know, they weren't going to become printers. They weren't going to become longshoremen. They weren't going to become factory workers. They, you know, because partly because of the, you know, the tax policies that you talked about, you know,
Our trade policies, yeah.
And the trade policies and the tax policies, that what they did was they started to blame people of color.
Yep.
You know, and a lot of that resentment started to come. You know, like back in the 90s, they talked about the angry white man. And, yeah. You know, we got a whole bunch of them in my family.
Well, that was the essence of Nixon's Southern strategy is look out, they're going to come and take your job.
Exactly, exactly. And you know something? I didn't get it until I was in my 40s. You see, I'm transgendered, and I started my transition when I was 45 years old.
Wow.
And during the first year that I was living as a woman, you know, when I was, like, still borderline, I got stopped and frisked by the police. You know, I experienced what a lot of African-American teenagers experience.
Right.
And I've experienced that kind of discrimination, too, you know, when I've looked for jobs.
Yep.
Kind of, and then even people, you know, former employers of mine who thought I was great and didn't want anything to do with me afterward. But, you know, I think the point is that, when you have this whole business owner class, investor class, who's parking their money in other places instead of investing it here and paying workers and creating jobs, that exacerbates the, the gap between the races, you know, the not just in income and
yes.
You know, economic inequality. But
it's the Hunger Games. It's pitting people against each other for the scraps.
Exactly, exactly. And I know there were times in my life when I found myself thinking like that. I was thinking, because I was trying to get a job teaching in college, and I thought, I have these credentials, but, they want to hire an African American, they want to hire a Hispanic, whatever.
Right.
And then what happened was, ironically, a female friend of mine ended our friendship because she was convinced that I changed genders because I'm trying to get a women's studies job that should go to a woman. You know, she was completely, and to this day she's convinced, which of course I did know such thing.
Sure, yeah. So you found your, that's amazing. So when you became visibly a minority or out as a minority, you got it how the minority experience of the world. Justine, that's brilliant. Thanks so much for listening to WBAI, and thanks so much for calling. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour. We really just have about 8 minutes left in the show, and I've got a full board of calls. So I'm just going to ask everybody to be fairly brief in what you're saying, and let's try to get through as many as we can. Guy in Cuba, New York, you wanted to talk about the Stand Your Ground thing.
Yes. I was wondering, I didn't hear on the show, I was wondering if you knew about the interview of Don's ex-neighbor?
No.
Oh, this has been on the, you got to hear this, it's been on the, what was on
Democracy Now!
This morning?
Yeah.
This guy was an ex-neighbor. He knew this guy for years. He thought he was nuts. The guy he'd be a friendly guy, but if you crossed him, he'd get in your face and start yelling at the guy. But he said he was bugging the guy all the time, his new pistol, that he's just dying for somebody to confront him. And he wants to use this pistol. And I'm surprised it's not on the show.
Against a black person, that there was a racial animus, or was this just the guy had anger management issues?
Apparently he had anger management, but the guy said he was nuts. He says, man, this guy, he was supposed to appear in the court, but the weather stopped him. They're going to fly him to the court for this.
Yeah, amazing.
And
Guy, I'll have to track that down. Thanks for the heads up, and thanks for alerting me to it. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Thank you for taking my call. It's one of these issues where I'm a bit torn in that I absolutely am on the same page with you in terms of stand your ground laws. I think that it's an example of unforeseen consequences wherein you basically give license to people to kill someone else out of a notion of fear without taking into consideration that fear can be generated by an irrational notion of things like racism.
Right. Fear doesn't actually necessarily equate with actual threat.
Exactly. Now, here's where it becomes problematic with regard to some of the anecdotal evidence that people have offered up, and I appreciate they want to call in and talk about that. Statistically, Unfortunately, and this has to do with the fact that disenfranchisement, the oppression, the conditions in which African-Americans have found themselves, because I would argue that if any group were subjected to what they were in this country's history, that they would find themselves in a similar situation, that there are disproportionately high levels of crime in this country among African-Americans, and they are actually the most victimized group in terms of who crime is perpetrated against. And rates of victimization do go up in proximity to African-Americans. In other words, no matter who you are, the closer you do live to an African-American community, your rate of victimization does go up. But again, that's the product of the social construct.
Well, that's only true if you're talking about a poor African-American community. It's very much not true if you're talking about middle-class or upper-middle-class African-American communities,
right,
which do exist in America, which many white people don't realize.
Right. When we talk about upper middle class and beyond that, we're talking about an extremely small group of African American communities.
And I don't think it's so extremely small. I mean, when I lived in Atlanta, there's fairly large middle class black suburbs in Atlanta that you don't have to be afraid of.
Atlanta's not known for that. I mean, that's not nationwide. That's anecdotal. Yeah. So, and even in working class African American communities, the crime rates are significantly higher. For instance, African American males with a college degree are twice as likely to commit murder as their white counterparts. So there is, again,
that statistic, I'm not, you know, I can't let that stand. I don't believe
it.
And secondly, I would say that the association here with poverty is much greater than the association with race. And Steve, we'll have to continue this. As I said, I want to get a bunch of callers in here. Lance in Clinton, Kentucky. You wanted to answer David, who called in?
Yeah. You know, this morning I got up and I started watching the local news.
Yeah.
And I watched the weather report and they said it was going to be 50 degrees and a chance of rain. So I grabbed my hoodie and I headed to the store because I had to get some bread and milk. Two things happened on the way. One, Led Zeppelin's Kashmir came on the radio. Led Zeppelin, and that song is my favorite song, so I cranked it up.
Uh-oh.
I got into the parking lot, and two, it started to rain. Now, in between time, an African-American couple came out of the store and got into the car next to me, put their groceries away. I smiled at him. I gave him a thumbs up. The song ended. I got out of the car, and I put my hoodie over my head and my hands in my pocket. I walked into the store, past a few American or African American people, nobody gave me a second look. Now,
and nobody shot you.
Yeah, if one of them would have shot me, do you think they would have got off on stand your ground laws?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And that was my point. And that's what the Tampa Bay Times say. Defendants claiming stand your ground are more likely to prevail if the victim is black. 73% of those who kill a black person face no penalty, compared to 59% of those who killed a white person. Lance, thanks for sharing your story with us. Winston in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Hey, Winston.
The movements of him are trying to fish in my vehicle.
I beg Winston. Winston, you're on the air. Do you know that?
Oh yeah, I know that now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. What were you going to say?
Thanks for taking my call. I need to say to you, I like your charisma, man.
Thank you.
You speak eloquent, and you speak so correctly that, I mean, for a person of your intellect, I like the way you see things. There is no biasness with you.
Well, I'm sure there are, but Winston, we only have about a half a minute left, and it's all yours. What did you want to say?
Well, anyway, that case in Florida that guy shot the young man and got away with not getting charged for murder, I think it is a problem.
Yeah. So you're agreeing with me that we should be, and Joe Madison, he was on our first hour. Joe said, Tom, you and I and other people of goodwill have to get together, and we got to get these laws repealed in these 20 some odd states, because people are being killed as a consequence of these laws. So you're with us on that, Winston.
Of course, 100%.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the call and thanks for listening. And coming up tomorrow, all the latest news and information you won't be hearing from the corporate-owned news media. Plus, we'll have a rumble with conservative Daniel Webster, the founder of the Association of Mature American Citizens, who says we need the Keystone XL pipeline right now. Yeah, right. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually begins with you getting active. Show up. Participate. Do something. Tag. You're it. Get out there. Get active and occupy some. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.